Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 29th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, I am deep underground in a hurricane safety bunker. Actually, I'm recording this on Thursday, so hopefully New York City is still standing. Hopefully everybody was smart enough, if it was to hit New York City, to get out. But be that as it may, I still have a show for you today. I am probably at the beach right now, unless I could convince Nikki that we shouldn't go, because it's going to be raining and possibly massive wind blowing or whatever windiness. Anyways, folks, just because my vacation's been horribly destroyed doesn't mean that you have to suffer. For today, for you, I have a great interview with Rick Perlstein, the author of Nixonland, a great historian. It's based on a piece he wrote about how Democrats have always won, and almost exclusively won, in the past 70 years when they fully and unabashedly embrace our social insurance programs. And then, following Rick Perlstein, a segment of my interview with David Cross. If you want the full interview, what you can do is donate your account to Facebook or be a member of the Majority Report. We'll give it as a bonus to members by the end of the week. We will come up with a device in which to do that. But you can IM us at Majority FM. Excuse me. You can tweet us at Majority FM, or you can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com if you want to do the donate your Facebook account move. But what you really should do, folks, is become a member of the Majority Report. Join that elite few, extremely few, but highly elite group of people who've become members of the Majority Report and pay a measly 33 cents a day, not just to get the content that you get on a daily basis as a free person, as a freeloader, but also all the stories, not just stories about Mila and her craziness, but real news stories and thoughtful news stories that we talk about in the better half of the show that members have access to. Or you can roll the dice, not become a member, have me go away and become, I don't know, a farmer or an insurance salesman, and then just rely on your cable television so that they can just tell you 90 times a day that Sarah Palin's a moron. Maybe there's an option three, where if you give me 33 cents a day, I will also include the words Sarah Palin's a moron in every one of our membership, our better half shows. All right, so that's my pitch, folks. Enjoy this Rick Perlstein interview. Enjoy the Cross interview. And take care of yourself. And tomorrow on the program, I'll be talking to Greg Mitchell about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Dahlia Lithwick, who will be talking about the Republican attacks on the National Labor Relations Board. On Wednesday, I'll be talking to Chris Hayes of The Nation magazine and Abe Sauer of The All, about his 2 years following the Tea Party. And then we'll have to see what happens on Thursday. All right, folks, thanks for joining us.
So, Rick, let's start with how you came to write this piece. It was based upon a story that was in Time from that Joe Klein wrote, that President Obama was reading your book, which is a fantastic book. I know we've talked about it in the past, Nixon Land. And you wanted to make sure that President Obama learned the right lessons from it.
I got a little cojones that way, you know.
Well, I mean, of course. I mean, you. It's important because you know, it's an amazing piece of scholarship, and frankly, you want it's not impossible for people to read something and walk away with a different perspective.
Right. I mean, you know, as the story goes, you know, I was sitting on a couch one Saturday, and someone called me and said, "Did you see this? And Obama's reading your book." And I said, you know, no frickin' way. And, you know, I pulled up Joe Klein's column. And by the way, Time has gone to a pay format, so I was able to read the first paragraph. But immediately I had an apprehension about it, because a lot of people kind of within sort of what you know, some of us call the village, you know, the kind of D.C. kind of echo chamber world, have, in fact, read Nixon Land and got a very certain lesson from it. You know, one of the people is, what's his name, the editor of Newsweek. You know, he's a big Nixon Land fan. But the message he gets from it is, wow, you know, Richard Nixon was so divisive and things were so divisive and this is what started dividing the country. And so here's a book that provides an allegory that says we need to be less divisive, and the way we need to be less divisive is to, you know, get together in a bipartisan way and sing Kumbaya, and, you know, elites in both parties need to lay down their arms and be nice to each other.
And I have to say at this point that the concern that President Obama, of all people, would take that message is, I think, fairly justified by his own rhetoric and his policies, frankly.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, it would be great if, you know, both sides would lay down their arms and be nice to each other. I mean, it would also be great if I were 6 feet tall, you know. But, you know, that ain't going to happen. And that's not how the world worked. And that's not what the world looked like, you know, prior to Richard Nixon coming along and bringing a certain brand of division. Not division as such, because the country is always going to be divided. It's been divided before it existed as a country, and will be divided, you know, unto the fourth generation after our, you know, we're all dead and buried. That's just the nature of a nation, especially one as big and complex as ours.
Right, and theoretically, we wouldn't need political parties, would we? I mean, we wouldn't need any of that.
I've never seen a big country that didn't have political parties that were divided, you know, on major questions about how to run the world. That's just a reality. But my bigger point in writing a book like Nixon Land is that one way of dividing the country was transplanted by another way of dividing the country. There's the New Deal way of dividing the country, which is there are ordinary people working hard, playing by the rules, who are fighting for their birthright as middle-class Americans and who are being blocked in their aspirations by the right and by corporate America. Then there's, you know, what Franklin Roosevelt called the malefactors of great wealth. And in that epic struggle, which has existed, by the way, in all modern capitalistic societies, the bulwark who was fighting for the middle class was the Democratic Party, was the kind of center-left party of the labor left. And that's always the case in every modern society. You have basically a party of money and a party of the people. And so long as the Democrats kind of kept their eyes on the prize and made their appeal to the people, as happened, you know, again and again since the New Deal, based on this theme of helping ordinary Americans get by against the depredations of the free market, the Democrats did pretty well. And when that broke down was when the Republicans, you know, sort of starting especially with Richard Nixon, started playing to those cultural resentments in a way that we know so well. And the best way to tamp down the power of that kind of resentment-driven, bitterness-driven cultural political economy is through an economic populist political economy. So, you know, I tell the story in the article in Time that I wrote, I tell the story of a very famous speech that was given on the eve of the 1970 election, which really looked like it was going to be a great election for the Republicans, because Richard Nixon and the National Republican Party had framed it as, we are the party of safety and security and law and order, and the Democrats are the party of violence, of hippies in the streets, of race riots. They framed it classically according to these cultural resentments.
And this is an off-year election, correct?
An off-year congressional election, right. And Richard Nixon gives this angry speech talking about the Democratic Party as the party of, basically cultural insecurity. Right after that speech, the senator from Maine, Edmund Muskie, gives this absolutely brilliant speech in which he talks about the Republican Party as a party that was trying to scare you. And he talked in a way that sounds exactly like what Tom Frank talks about in What's the Matter with Kansas. He literally said they're trying to scare you to vote against yourself. And he talked about the Republicans as the party that sided with the bankers in every question, Republican parties that, you know, was the party that wanted to undo the social safety net, undo Medicare, undo Social Security. The thing about it was also a speech in which he spoke very calmly. He sounded in a lot of ways like Barack Obama. And he proved in that speech, after which, by the way, on that next Tuesday, the Democrats completely swamped the Republicans in a complete upset. He proved that talking about those issues is not divisive. It's uniting. Franklin Roosevelt proved when he talked about the bankers as people who didn't have the best interests for middle-class Americans that kind of language is not divisive. It's united. It's uniting. After all, Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 built the most diverse and strongest and biggest political coalition in the Democratic Party in American history. He also, by the way, 5 years later, united the entire country to defeat fascism. So the idea that Franklin Roosevelt was a divisive figure, that doesn't fly.
Right. Well,
it doesn't fly now.
We have to take a break, Rick. But when we come back, let's talk about that. And I want to also touch on those cultural issues and really define our terms in terms of what does it mean to be divisive. I mean, not everybody is going to be with the program. There's always going to be someone who is going to lose in some fashion. And let's talk specifically about who that is when we come back. So, Rick, when we took a break, you were talking about how the story that you tell in Nixon land, that coming up on that 1970 off-year election when everyone anticipated the Republicans to do quite well, a speech by Edmund Muskie at the time where he espoused the traditional Democratic economic populism, and did it as a way to deflect the cultural attacks that the Republicans were waging upon in this race. I mean, that is one of the things that people have talked about that I've read quite a bit lately, that the and I think it was Kevin Drum had a piece on something like this where there was a cleavage between the traditional blue-collar union Democratic voter and the liberals in the party who were pursuing a more social and cultural agenda of emancipation for women, for minorities.
It was a very real division. You know, Kevin Phillips, back in the day when he was a Nixon staffer, called those kinds of Democrats the Toryhood of change. You know, they kind of wanted to remake the world in a way that often felt very disruptive to kind of ordinary middle-class Americans.
And that was that's when sort of the union movement began to lose its sort of synchronistic relationship with the Democratic Party. And as they fell off as an electoral support for the party, the Democratic leadership started to look for corporate money, and this becomes a self-fulfilling cycle. And
that's in about 20 words or less, that's the history of the Democratic Party in the 70s.
And so we have this situation where that gulf, even though it was not as wide as it would be later, and I think there's a large argument that that gulf has shrunk actually now because people are just more, people aren't afraid of gay people.
And basically the fact is, most of us Democratic activists have learned our lesson. We respect, the cultural sort of the interests and stability that most white middle class people have. And we're not talking about America as this, evil country anymore,
So in many respects, the argument that you're making is that not only was Muskie very effective at that time in presenting a populist argument against this notion of divisiveness or cultural divisiveness, but in many respects, demographically speaking and almost psychographically speaking, we're in a similar place, aren't we, in terms of when I look at what happened in Madison, we see that ability to sort of like those two elements of the Democratic coalition are as close to each other as they've been probably since 1970.
It's so true, Sam. I remember I went to Madison. I live in Chicago. It was only a four-hour drive. I had to go, right? And I went the day in which the fugitive Wisconsin Congress people returned to Madison triumphantly and marched to the Capitol. So I had that experience. And all I could think of was, this crowd here, and I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it, looks exactly like Fox News says the Republican coalition looks like. Quote unquote, they look like America. And, right, all places aren't like that. Like Wisconsin's a pretty white state. And, the great thing about the Democratic Party is we do let in everyone, right? We respect everyone. But in Madison, I thought of these guys who maybe some of them were overweight, maybe some of them had a cultural taste that may not match with folks in Georgetown or Marin County, But these people were absolutely making their stand with and for the Democratic Party and with and for the Democratic Party's traditional values. And had the National Democratic Party and had the White House made this point that, look, this is the Democratic Party. We're not these monsters that the Republicans have been shoving in your face for a generation. They could have done 30 years. They could have undone 30 years of negative propaganda by the Republicans and the conservative coalition. Because this was a movement, and is a movement, by the way, it's still going on, that looks like America.
This was the day that the tractors came into the Capitol.
Farmers.
Right.
Tractors. I remember, the first person I talked to when I was waiting for the bathroom, and by the way, this was these people were liberals, right? I remember waiting for the bathroom. That's when I met a bunch of the people. And people were doing kind of bathroom triage. Instead of having a line, the person who had to go the worst went first. Right? But I remember talking to a woman, and she said, this is the biggest crowd I've seen since I started coming here. And I said, well, when did you start? How many times have you come? And she said, I've been here six times. And I said, where do you live? She said, Superior, Wisconsin. Superior, Wisconsin is 6 hours away from Madison, right? So we have people, making the trek regularly. People who, quote, unquote, look like America, look like Fox News viewers are supposed to look. And this is this enormous source of energy, this enormous source of activist potential for the Democratic Party. And for the National Democratic Party to leave that political energy on the table, for the Democratic Party to give up the opportunity to reorient the election around these themes of restoring the middle class, that's a act of political malpractice of the first water. It's historically stupid.
Now, I was there that day. I'm sad we didn't run into each other, and I was struck by
there were too many people to run into each other.
There was so many people there, and you're right. I mean, you had teaching assistants from University of Madison side by side with welders.
Turtles and Teamsters, right?
And there were cops and there were firemen that came in there. It was an amazing crowd, but.
A lot of them traditional Republican voters too.
Exactly,
a lot of those cops
and firemen, I think, were very surprised. And in fact, I think it was those days too that they were pulling their money out of banks that were supportive of Scott Walker. But
it's called solidarity, brother, and this is how we turn the political situation around.
But now this political malpractice that you're talking about, what accounts for this? I mean,
well,
this
has a history too, right?
Yes.
A lot of the Democrats who kind of came to power with kind of the Watergate reaction, the people like, you know, some of them great public servants who have done great things, but, you know, people like, you know, Gary Hart was the guy who kind of was the leader of this new class. He'd been George McGovern's campaign manager. You know, George McGovern, a great heroic guy who's done a lot of wonderful stuff. But Gary Hart said the day he was elected, we're not a bunch of little Hubert Humphreys. And so he basically kind of, you know, took a dump on the guy, Hubert Humphrey, who had been fighting and would continue to fight for those kind of union-based liberal labor values the hardest. And if you look at what those guys were for, a lot of them represented kind of suburban districts, more affluent districts. And, you know, I mean, I'm not coming up with this stuff. You know, this is books like Thomas Ferguson's Right Turn, which came out in the middle of the 80s, writes about this. What's his name? Tom Etzel's The New Politics of Inequality tells this story beautifully and brilliantly. And a lot of these guys ended up kind of abandoning this kind of traditional New Deal politics. And you know who else did? Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, the very first thing he did when he was president was when he wrote his first budget, he canceled a bunch of public works projects, water projects, because he wanted to show kind of like Barack Obama, that he was above the kind of usual backslapping politics as usual. So he kind of took that sort of political money off the table to prove that he was a new kind of Democrat, you know, in a familiar phrase. And then in 1978, in his State of the Union address, he said, and this should sound very familiar, the government cannot create jobs, the government cannot fight poverty, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So this kind of retreat from you know, good, efficient government as the protector of middle class interests has always been there within sort of the Democratic leadership since the 70s, and it's just become more and more dominant, more and more corporate friendly, more and more bank friendly. I mean, who was the guy who was Carter's Treasury Secretary? He was a, you know, prominent local banker in Atlanta. Tony Coelho in the 1980s became the head of the DCCC, and he was a fundraiser who just really just said the Democratic Party has to be a party that is safe for billionaires. You know, this is the kind of cool billionaires versus the uncool billionaires thing. So, and then we have the new Democrats in Clinton. So this has been there for a long time. It's not like this, you know, was kind of invented by Barack Obama. But now it's kind of come to dominate the Democratic Party, and we're reaping the whirlwind because of that.
So, Rick, so you have this situation, okay, where the party has moved in this direction. And the interesting thing is that it seems to me the conventional wisdom is that people were responding to McGovern's loss, and they made this change towards away from labor and towards corporations. But I think, and I say this as a big fan of McGovern in many, many, many respects. In fact, my political... to the extent that I was brought up political, it was because I met McGovern at my house in 1972.
Really?
Just by a fluke.
You're absolutely a lot younger than that.
I was 6 years old and not eligible to vote at the time. But my understanding of McGovern is that he also rejected these union members. That,
he did.
That
that's,
he...
That, I tell that story in Nixon land.
Yeah, well, that's probably where I found it out, actually.
It was a mutual contempt.
And this was that part, sadly, that part of the DNA stayed in the Democratic
right.
Party. And,
yeah, and to get deep with it, you know, basically it has a lot to do with the fact that America in the 60s was such a prosperous country. And the idea that the middle class was vulnerable or would ever be vulnerable was kind of unimaginable. So, you know, it's almost like this kind of snuck up on people, you know, with the oil shocks of the 70s. And suddenly, you know, this kind of hyper growth, this kind of explosion in middle class income and middle class security, such that folks could buy vacation cabins, you know, who didn't even have indoor plumbing a generation earlier, suddenly collapsed. So, you know, in a way, this, it's not necessarily that there were a lot of villains. You just had a lot of myopia.
And the interesting thing is that the flip side of that is, and I think Tom Hartman writes about this in Screwed, is that the political confidence that was gained because of what Krugman calls the Great Compression, because of that incredible amount of financial security that was felt within the middle class. The political confidence to go out and to protest and to say, you know what, it doesn't matter if I get arrested in college because I'm going to have a job.
Absolutely. You could bomb a building one day and get a job at IBM the next, practically. There,
exactly. And that created that the flip side of that is what actually convinced people like Powell to write his memo at the time to say that we must take back this political power and we must do it on economic terms. So all of this is tied together, and it all happens in a very short period of time. And I guess the question is now, when this path was chosen by the Democratic establishment 30 years ago now.
How do you
come back? I mean, we have gone so far down this road. Yeah. The establishment has gone so far down this corporate friendly road. We see it day in, day out now. How do we go back?
You know how you do it, Sammy? You shove the polls in their faces. You shove the polls in their faces that say 80% of the country wants higher tax bracket for incomes over a million. You shove the 30 separate polls that say Americans want tax increases for the rich. You shove the polls that say 60 to 70% of Americans say job creation is more important than deficit reduction. You play to politicians' greed to get and keep their jobs. And that's the secret right here. And that's the secret right here. We're going to see more and more Democratic politicians turned out for rejecting the middle class's birthright. And politicians do not like losing their job, and this is the appeal we have to make to them.
And I agree with you on this, but isn't this entire super committee apparatus essentially built so that the establishment can carry out the agenda of cutting Social Security and Medicare and be inoculated from accountability and from a backlash from the voters, so that because everybody's in this boat together, everybody voted for it, so you cannot measure the voter discontent based on that.
Wow, you know, I hadn't thought about it that way, and that's pretty cunning and pretty depressing. You know, that's the kind of thing that kind of settles a gloom of learned helplessness over us all. You know, look. You know, if we don't fight, who the hell is? You know?
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think to a certain extent, you know, I think it is 30 or 40 years later since we started heading down this path. And it's impossible to imagine that we're going to be able to write this, with one election or two elections or three elections. You know, I think certainly 5 or 6 years ago when we were talking, we were not talking about these issues in the same way.
We weren't talking about them on January 20th, 2009.
That's right.
We were talking about reversing the course of plutocracy.
That's right. And now, you know, I think the one thing that I think is advantageous, I guess, if we want to look at a silver lining in terms of people's disappointment with President Obama, is that that is coming into stark relief. And I guess that's the first. That's the first step, I guess, towards trying to turn it back.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on a magazine article. And I don't want to say too much because you never know how these things are going to come out, whether it's even going to be published or not. But you know, I've been looking into what MoveOn.org and Van Jones have been doing with what they call the American Dream movement or Rebuild the Dream, and their whole notion is that people get it.
Right.
And there's lots of disparate threads in which people are expressing this, whether it's the Verizon strike or people yelling at their Republican congressmen at town halls or yelling at their Democratic congressmen at town halls or showing up at state capitals when Wisconsin stuff happens. And by the way, both Scott Walker and Kasich in Ohio are running scared from their former recalcitrant positions when it comes to this stuff. So something's working.
Right. And pressure is working. That's actually a good segue into what I wanted to really ask you from a historical perspective. You mentioned all these things that are happening in this country in terms of what is, if not an articulated, maybe a visceral understanding that there is a plutocracy and they are running things, and it is not for the benefit of the vast, vast majority of people. I mean, even that may even understate it. But has there ever been a year since 1968 that we see this type of it's not revolt in this country, but it is maybe the beginning, the inklings of it. But we're seeing this 300,000 people marching in Israel, which would be the functional equivalent of 6 or 7 million in this country, marching about privatization.
Yeah, calling for revolution.
You have 100,000 people marching in Greece. You have tens of 50, maybe 100 thousands in Spain. You have people marching in France. You have people in Egypt. And it's been very undersold how much that was about economics.
Yeah.
And across much of the Arab Spring, you have the riots in Britain. Has there ever been a year that you're aware of as a historian that has had this much widespread protest against the establishment, not because of war, but because of money and because of just distrust of the establishment since 1968?
I guess I can't say 1848, huh?
Well, you're older than I am.
No. So, you know, there's, you know, maybe that's time for hope. I mean, I guess the point I would make in response to that is, you know, history is a cunning master. And, you know, no one saw, you know, 1932 coming in 1929. You know, no one saw, you know, 1917 coming in 1915. You know, no one saw 1968 coming in 1964, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, history sometimes turns on a hinge and its pattern becomes obvious to us in retrospect. So, you know, we don't know what's going to happen next. We really, really don't. And I'm not being glib, and I'm not trying to, you know, do happy talk, because I think that Barack Obama is really bad at his job. I think he's historically, again, to use that metaphor, left so much money on the table when it comes to political capital. I think that the forces of plutocracy are united and confident as they never have before. But, you know, maybe these guys are forcing contradictions that they're not going to be able to contain.
From your mouth, Rick Perlstein.
Inshallah.
Exactly. To God's ears. Thank you so much for joining me.
Take care, brother.
Always a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way I'm slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah. And you wasn't the man. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton.
Hello.
Hello, David Cross.
Hi, Sam Cedar.
Oh, I was going to pretend like I had somebody who would actually call. Bring me onto the phone.
Then why didn't you do anything to disguise your voice?
Well, you know, that would have probably been a good idea. I thought I was just banking on maybe you forgot what I sounded like.
Okay, nope. Just talk to you.
Hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Today on the phone is David Cross. You may know David from the chicken pot pie episode of that show. I can't remember, but I do remember that you don't like that, that reference.
Right.
And, of course,
it's not that I don't like it.
It's annoying.
Yeah. It's annoying, and it's, 12 years old at this point?
Well, look, I have been talking about, in fact, virtually the only credits I have are 12 years old, so that's not, time's not an issue in this context. Don't get caught up in that.
In your context, in my context, it is.
Well, look, this is not the Cross Report, this is the Majority Report, and so that's...
Right, well, things are different when you're, you know,
successful. No, I get that. I get that. You don't have to dance around.
The modern equivalent of operating a ham radio out of your nana's garage. So come on, let's.
Yeah, I mean,
call a spade a spade.
There's. What do you mean the? What do you mean the equivalent? what makes you think that we're not using a ham radio technology here?
In fact, 80% of this entire thing, we just introduced a computer to this entire equation.
And you still have one of those big ones, right? It takes up most of the space.
Yeah,
there.
We got to get rid of these CRT things, man. Everybody's got these flat screen monitors now. We got to upgrade this. Incredibly stupid decisions.
The increasingly poor decisions of Todd Margaret.
I call it IPTM. IPDTM. But it's on IFC, and I was just telling you, I think I just said, I don't know if we'll keep that part of the interview on, but I don't, with serialized things, I don't watch them now one at a time.
And as I said, I get it. I totally get that. In fact, it's far more enjoyable for me to start watching TV where I don't have to wait, especially, as you say, with serialized things where there's a bit of a cliffhanger from episode to episode, and you can watch three in a row, go to bed, watch the rest of it the next day, have a marathon. You know, you watch it on your time. You don't have to watch commercials. That's how I think most people watch television nowadays. You know, it's changed irrevocably.
And I'll tell you, that's the great thing about the opportunity for you to do a show that was, at the very least, half a British production, because that is the way they do shows there.
Yes.
I mean, not just serialized, but they do it. They don't. You know, that's the problem. I mean, I think the biggest problem with American television has been this notion of open-ended commitments, because it makes it impossible to really fashion a story that has some type of direction and push. Now, you know, your half-hour sitcoms, I find them rarely.
Well, I don't think that's the biggest problem. I think if by problem you're connoting the idea of, like, why is a show not as good as it could be or as enjoyable, I think the problem is based on commerce, capitalism. They have to a show has to be successful enough at being able to either get publicity for the network and the other shows around it, or it's popular enough to get enough advertising revenue so that it justifies the existence of the show. If that's the end result that everybody's shooting for, then the interior and creative and intellectual makeup of that show is going to be dictated by what people at the network.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, it's the network thing. I mean, because I look at a show like Louis. I look at Louis' show, and I think that's a great show, and he has total control over that show, and it's also not serialized.
Yeah.
But he has total control over that show because it's so low budget.
Right. Yes. And that's a great way to do TV, or that show, certainly. You know, and he does everything. And I know he's not compensated nearly as much as other people, but that's the exception, though, not the rule.
I think it's possible I make more on this podcast than he makes on that show.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
Such a small budget. I'm not joking. You know, people, like, he had on his computer. I was talking to the other people not listening, not you.
Right.
When I say I'm not joking. But all right. Well, so be that as it may, I mean, we can quibble over the order of the problems with American television because they're all in there. But you spent the past 2 years in Britain working on TPDTM.
It's not that hard. TIPDTM.
Is this something that when you guys sit down to create a television show, do you sit down and say, hey, like, we should think about this title a little bit differently because of the way if the initials aren't going to roll off the tongue?
I mean, everything for me starts with the initials,
I guess that's why they call it initial.
Or anachronism? No, what is that?
Not anagram?
Anachronism. What is it?
Starts
not
with
anagram. That's when you mix. That's when you mix up the letters.
Words with friends.
Yes, words with friends. It's a common word. I'm spacing on it when I just when it's the initials.
Anacronym.
Yes, thank you.
I can't.
Anacronym. I believe. Maybe I'm wrong. But yeah, it always starts with that. So we did some research. Paid a good chunk of money. It was about £25,000, which, you know, as you know, is roughly $42,000.
Mm-hmm.
To this company in Bristol, and they came up with the letters that would be, you know, most amenable to people that ones that they would remember that would work. And so we got those letters. So then we came up with a title based on those letters.
Oh,
EIPTM. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, there you have it, folks. There's some like serious insight into how television works in Britain. And frankly, I think for $42,000, you got a deal.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people tend to like it. You like it, you know. I mean, you.
I like how you use two T's. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So, what was it like living in Britain? I mean, you didn't, you know, you weren't a big international traveler before you went. I mean, you had been over to Britain before to do stand up, but I mean, what's it like to live essentially to be an expat for a couple of years?
I love London, and if you're going to be, and I'm a very kind of urban creature, and I like cities, and I like stuff happening all around me, and accessibility. So if you're going to be away from New York, London's certainly a good as good a substitute as you might be able to find. I definitely missed being. You know, I missed having a lot of my friends, and I missed the concept of friends. I had friends over there, but not nearly as many as I do back in the States, whether I'm in New York or L.A. or Atlanta or wherever I am. So I kind of missed that. I missed, you know, I had a lot of meals by myself. That kind of gets a little aggravating after a while. And
wow, so you really, really, really were shunned by the British.
Well, I'm not,
did it feel like elementary school
that,
for you? Was it like elementary school in high school?
No. I'm not saying when I walked into a restaurant, people would leave in disgust and leave me there by myself. I'm just saying I didn't have a table companion. I had plenty of friends, but they have their own lives. You know, they got husbands and wives and kids and girlfriends and all that. And I would definitely hang out with people, but
whatever you have to tell yourself.
The majority of the time, no, you know.
Well, but I mean, how did it look? Let me ask you this. I mean, what sort of interests me specifically about that sort of like is that your job is fundamentally to communicate. I presume you did stand up over there occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, I was approached. The origin of Todd Margaret was I was doing 2 weeks at the 100 Club, and some women from RDF Productions approached me. This back in 2007 about, you know, would I be interested in trying to create a show that would be for British television, but also potentially for American television as well, co-production with...
Isn't that daunting? Isn't it daunting to do a show for, I mean, you know, obviously Britain is you know, is not so radically different from our culture, but isn't that a little bit daunting to do a show for a British audience?
No, not really. I get asked a lot. In fact, probably more than any other question, you know, regarding the show and the how we did it and the origin of it, about the differences between British humor and American humor, which really aren't. Maybe 30 years ago, there was a more marked, noticeable difference, but. You know, they get a lot of American TV over there, and we get plenty of British TV, and comedy nerds are comedy nerds, whether they have an English accent or not, you know, and we all kind of like the same things and are influenced by the same things, And so there really wasn't. And also, I had a really great experienced co-writer who was British, and we wrote the first six, and then we had another writer brought in for the next six. But you know, we're making ourselves laugh, and there's if there's any confusion, and there rarely was, you just go, you know, you explain what the reference is, and then you sort of alter it so everybody gets it. But that didn't really happen much. And there's, you know, it wasn't daunting as much as it was kind of exciting and you know, to be a little self-centered about it was also very gratifying that I could do this thing, that I'd be asked to do this thing that would bridge the two groups, you know. And because I know you and so many of our mutual friends, comedians, and people we started out with back in the 90s in Boston, or 80s, I guess, late 80s, you know, we're huge Anglophiles.
Yeah.
So, you know.
We watched that that Harry Enfield, Sir Norbert Smith, I think it was, like, literally wore out the tape heads on that thing.
Yeah. I mean, we would go, I think we must have watched that 15, 20 times.
Yeah.
You know, after shows.
And at least once almost sober.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
No, probably not. I mean, I used to steal it away and watch it sober just to see what it was like. It's like sort of almost like masturbating.
Hold on.
Yeah, I mean, no, but I would use, never mind. We cut that part out. This is going to be a recorded. Yeah, so, I mean, that's good. Did you, and you were able to bring in British comedians that you liked, that you appreciated too, right?
Oh, yeah. The cast is, you know, half American, half British. But really, the cream of the crop. I mean, there's some really, I mean, there's some people who are in it for 60 seconds that are, you know, some fucking top-notch comedy actors, you know, that I was thrilled and lucky to have as a part of it, you know. It was great. It was a great experience, and I wouldn't trade it in for anything. I'm definitely glad that the story is over. I wouldn't want to do a third year. I wouldn't want to spend another year in London, you know. It's a little difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine it's hard.
And I miss baseball, too, man. I miss watching baseball a lot.
I don't know if people realize. I mean, I saw you do the interview with Olbermann. You guys were talking about your rotisserie league. I don't know if people appreciate how much of a baseball fan you are, and I don't know that it's really relevant. But I guess for like, we attract probably a half a dozen comedy nerds to this podcast when we have a comedian on, and so they'd probably be interested to know how much of a huge baseball fan you are. It's probably because of your allergies.
Because of the allergies?
Yeah, you can't go out and do anything in the summer. I mean, I've seen you throw a baseball. Let's put it that way. I mean, a softball.
Sure.
Come on.
No, I mean, you get allergies, you know, for 7-8 days a week in spring and in fall. But other than that, you're able to go out.
Not really. Go with it.
They have sprays and pills and all kinds of things.
Shots. Just go with it.
Shots.
Go with it. As a kid.
Yeah. I was in a plastic bubble for the greater part of all my summers, and I grew up in Georgia, and the summer there is a little longer than most other places, and you know, you're talking about half your year in a bubble, and I would watch TV. And watch baseball.
We just literally got the quote for our tweet about this interview.
Okay.
I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Sure. guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years while I shifted in and out. My power.